Hello, welcome to Heart Failure Beat, a podcast produced by the Heart Failure Society of America.
Heart Failure Beat is designed specifically for clinicians who treat heart failure patients in the United States of America and around the world.
We are your hosts. I'm Dr. Priya Mapathy, an assistant professor of medicine and advanced heart failure and transplant cardiologist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland.
And my name is Dr. Michael Beasley, assistant professor of medicine and an advanced heart failure and transplant cardiologist at the Yale School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Now let's get to our episode.
Welcome to Heart Failure Rounds. This month, I'm going to discuss an article that was authored by Laura Gelfman, who hails from the Brookdale Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York, New York, with the senior author being Dr. Larry Allen from the Division of Cardiology, Department of Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine in Aurora, Colorado. This paper was called Palliative Care Across the Spectrum of Heart Failure, a state-of-the-art review, and was published in JACC Heart Failure. Palliative care plays a crucial role in managing heart failure by striving to improve the quality of life of patients and their families throughout their journey. Integrating palliative care into heart failure management has been shown to have significant benefits, such as improved symptom control, better quality of life, and increased caregiver satisfaction. It is important to note that palliative care in heart failure is not limited to end-of-life care. It is about enhancing the quality of life for patients and their families throughout their entire journey. The authors discuss integrating palliative care with heart failure management, highlighting its positive impact on symptom control, quality of life, and caregiver satisfaction. The paper emphasizes the dynamic clinical trajectory of heart failure, which presents distinct symptom patterns and changing functional status, thus highlighting the need for adaptive palliative care models. Heart failure is not a static condition, but rather a dynamic one, with fluctuating symptom patterns and changing functional status. This variability underscores the need for adaptive palliative care models that can address patients' evolving needs as they navigate the ups and downs of their illness. Despite the numerous benefits, access to palliative care is not equal across all populations. Disparities in access are influenced by gender, race, and geography. Furthermore, a significant shortage of specialty trained palliative care clinicians further exacerbates the issue, making it challenging for many patients to access the care they need. It is vital for healthcare providers, including cardiologists and internal medicine clinicians, to undergo primary palliative care training to address the challenges they face. This training will equip them with the necessary skills and knowledge to provide basic palliative care, ensuring that all patients can access the support they need. Community-based palliative care services can also help to expand access, particularly in underserved communities. By providing care in patients' homes and communities, we can ensure that care is easily accessible and culturally sensitive. The author suggests innovative, evidence-based palliative care delivery models that involve diverse clinicians tailored to patients' unique needs and heart failure trajectories. However, implementing these models may be challenging and will require further high-quality research and trials in the heart failure population. Home-based and community-based palliative care services can enhance access, especially in underserved communities. By providing care in patients' homes and communities, we can meet them where they are and provide support that is both accessible and culturally sensitive. Caregivers play a crucial role in the journey of heart failure patients, yet their needs and experiences are often ignored. The paper emphasizes the importance of considering caregivers' experiences, quality of life, and burdens. It is essential to provide them with support and resources to help them navigate their role effectively. The role of caregivers in heart failure management is vital, and it is crucial to consider their needs and experiences. Effective palliative care requires innovative, evidence-based delivery models tailored to patients' needs and clinical trajectories. Challenges include the need for high-quality research and palliative care trials in the heart failure population. The paper covers studies on palliative care for advanced heart failure patients, including clinical trials, reviews, and meta-analyses. To date, the investigations conducted vary due to the uniqueness of the interventions trialed, and this results in limited analysis to recommend best practices. In conclusion, integrating palliative care into heart failure management is necessary for improving outcomes and enhancing the quality of life of patients and their families. Addressing disparities in access, innovating care delivery models, and supporting caregivers is crucial to ensuring that all patients receive the comprehensive care that they deserve. By doing so, we can ensure that every patient receives the medical attention they need to manage their heart failure and that their quality of life is improved. Well, thank you for joining me on this month's Heart Failure Rounds. Now, on to our featured monthly conversation.
Hello, all. Welcome to our Heart Failure Beat new podcast. I am ecstatic to be joined by an amazing cast today, headed by Celia DeFilippis. Dr. DeFilippis is a forefront and a leader examining women in heart failure and identifying gaps, places to go, things to get better. And Dr. Celia is an assistant professor in advanced heart failure and transplant cardiologist at the Columbia University Irving Medical Center. Welcome, Dr. DeFilippis. I'm also joined by my amazing co-host, Michael Beasley.
Hi, Priya. It's been a while. I'm hopeful you're doing well.
I'm doing well. I'm doing especially well because I'm all revved up to hear about all these cool issues we're going to talk about because it's a jam-packed podcast. We have Dr. DeFilippis and we have the other women in heart failure, our torchbearers of the Women in Transplant and Mechanical Circuitry Support Group, Dr. Eileen Sheesh. Dr. Sheesh is the medical director of the heart transplant program at the Cleveland Clinic. And Dr. Catherine Clark, she's an assistant professor and a heart failure and transplant cardiologist at the Yale University School of Medicine, and is colleagues with Michael.
Yeah, Catherine and I know each other just a little bit.
Fantastic. So welcome to all of you, and thank you again so much for taking time to come and chat with us. This issue of the Heart Failure Beat podcast is themed to talk about women and heart failure, both from the patient perspective and as a community. So I'll start off with Dr. DeFilippis. Thanks again for coming and chatting with us. And I just wanted to hear from you, Celia. When we think about women and heart failure, and this as a special population, some of the things that I think about are, what are really sort of the epidemiological characteristics that as women we face in heart failure? Everything from, do we get different cardiomyopathies? The answer is yes. Spoiler alert. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and what you identify really as some of the biggest gaps in our current evaluation and treatment of women in heart failure in our community.
Thank you so much, Priya and Michael, for inviting me to take part in this podcast today. I'm really excited to be here. I think in terms of the epidemiology of heart failure in women, so we do know that compared to men, women tend to have a lower lifetime risk of heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. However, I think this is often used as an excuse to say that this is why women are less likely or only make up about 20 to 25% of individuals who receive LVAD or heart transplantation. Because we do know that among white women, about 40% of their heart failure hospitalizations are for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. And we also know that for Black women, they actually have higher rates of heart failure with reduced ejection fraction than preserved ejection fraction. And so I think one of my goals is to understand the epidemiology, but also highlight the disparities and the bias with respect to referrals for advanced heart failure therapies, as well as enrollment in heart failure clinical trials, which are really pivotal when we try and understand and assess differences in efficacy and potential harm in men and women from pharmacologic therapies in heart failure. I will say we do know that there are some mechanistic differences that may account for differences in response to neurohormonal blockade, for example. So we know that women actually have decreased reactivity or ACE levels and increased expression of angiotensin II receptors. And so for this reason, there have been some meta-analyses that actually show that women respond better and have more favorable outcomes with ARBs as compared to ACE inhibitors. And perhaps this may be why we see some of the benefit that we see with respect to Paragon HF and some of the other ARNI analyses. Fortunately, with the SGLT2 inhibitors, there have been multiple analyses really across the spectrum of heart failure with regards to ejection fraction and sex, and show that there really is significant benefit. And then when we think about devices, it's really quite interesting because even though there have been myriad of studies showing that women are better responders to cardiac resynchronization therapy than women, they're still less likely to be counseled on ICD and CRT-D therapy. And interestingly, in one meta-analysis, it showed that women actually were better responders to CRTD, even at a QRS width of 130 to 149 milliseconds, even though this isn't really represented in our current guidelines, which just have the recommendation for CRTD greater than 150 milliseconds. And so I think these are just a few examples of the importance of understanding the differences that may be based in physiologic mechanisms, as well as the potential bias that can impact the care received by women with heart failure.
I think you just hit on so many incredibly important points in that summary, Celia, and thank you for doing that. I just want to kind of highlight a few things for our listeners that I think were important about what you just said. As you mentioned, the importance of needing to do a better job of enrolling women in clinical trials is going to be incredibly important moving forward. And as we should all know, that when our foundational trials that were completed, that are the basis upon which we have those four pillars of foundational therapy for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, women were not enrolled nearly as frequently as men in those trials. And if we truly are trying to practice evidence-based medicine, we really have an evidence gap there in some of these situations. And then also looking at what's your target dosing supposed to be. As we all know, we're not only supposed to be getting our patients started on all these foundational therapies, but up-titrating them to target doses. And as you mentioned, there could be some differences in physiological response that could make target dosing a bit different, possibly, and between men and women. And when these trials that were done predominantly enrolled men, it'll be interesting. It makes you wonder if our target dosing should be different depending on who that patient is sitting in front of us. And then another thing that you alluded to is the differences in advanced therapies evaluations and enrollment for patients undergoing those processes or the outcomes of those evaluation processes. It seems that women are less commonly referred for advanced therapies evaluations and sometimes could be less likely to be approved for advanced therapies. Some things that have kind of been written about that speak to that is sometimes psychosocial items might be unfairly held against women in these situations where they might not have the psychosocial support systems in place compared to a man because of not having a stable partner, for example. Other times, because unfairly we place obviously the role of child raising with women, and possibly sometimes we'll say that, you know, if we have a patient who's middle-aged or younger that has children, hold the fact that she has children against her as being a candidate for advanced therapies. And I'm sure there's so many others that could also be included in this role. But could you speak a little bit to the things that you've written about and the topics that you've encountered when trying to ascertain where the situation is and the disparities between men and women and being enrolled in evaluations for advanced therapies and being approved for such therapies?
Thank you so much. I think you raised some really important points. And one of my favorite studies, which I was not involved in, but I admire very much, was the study done by Dr. Khadija Breathitt, where she actually approached heart failure cardiologists at an international meeting, and she provided them with an identical patient vignette of someone who clearly met the classic I need help criteria for advanced heart failure. And the four variations of that vignette were solely changing the patient's sex and the patient's race and ethnicity. So there was one Black woman, Black male, a white woman, and a white man. As you alluded to, clinicians who kind of talked out their thought processes, and then this was qualitatively analyzed, the women were judged more harshly based on their appearance as compared to the men. There was also more concern about the adequacy of social support for women than men, and children were perceived as liabilities for women, particularly among African-American women. And there were also concerns about family dynamics and finances. And that, I think, also highlights this intersection between sex and race that we really cannot ignore when we're thinking about these referrals. In addition to those, I think from the medical aspects, I think some things that are worth discussing, one of which is allo sensitization, which disproportionately affects women. And we've also seen increased sensitization in Black individuals as compared to non-Black individuals. And so I think that's another concern that transplant centers may consider in their decision-making, particularly with the history of pregnancy leading to increased preformed antibodies. And for patients who are highly sensitized, it may be a deterrent for them to be listed given concern about them finding a suitable donor. I also think that there has been some data published about frailty and how that's perceived. And I think women are often perceived as more frail compared to men. And that may also be a medical reason for why they are declined. And I think some of those things also are encompassed by the fact that women are still referred later. And so they are presenting sicker. And many more women are presenting in cardiogenic shock that can accompany end organ dysfunction or other things that may cause them to be too sick from a medical standpoint. And so I think all of these things point to earlier referral for women, ideally establishing outpatient care with a heart failure provider, allowing conversations about advanced therapies to be done earlier and not in a cardiogenic shock in the intensive care unit. And this, of course, does not just apply to women, this applies to all individuals. But I do think that that is something that we've seen.
Cecilia, those are great points. And I think it looks like at every stage, there's an opportunity for us to think about what is the barrier to the next stage. So is there a more personalized approach to guideline-directed medical therapy? Is there a bias and a need for earlier referral? And even referral to decision was fraught with a lot of these disparities. And then when you get to decision, then there's also this idea of what are some special considerations when it comes to mechanical circuitry support in women who tend, you've written a lot about waitlist mortality and it being disproportionate with more women dying on the waitlist. And I wonder how many of those are related to complications for MCS. That is, no pun intended, one size fits all. And certainly that is not the case. So I wondered if you wanted to speak a little bit towards that.
Yes, Priya, thank you for bringing that up. Actually, Dr. Sheesh, who's on this call, did some of the really seminal research in the pre-2018 allocation system showing that women who were listed as status 1A at the highest acuity within that system experienced greater waitlist mortality and delisting for death or clinical deterioration compared to men. So we sought to look at that after the 2018 allocation system. When you look at all comers of all levels of acuity, we actually saw that women were more likely to undergo heart transplant compared to men without any differences in delisting or death. And even when they were less likely to receive a balloon pump or they were at a lower UNOS priority tier. And we attributed that, hypothesizing that with some of the changes in geographic sharing, that maybe that allowed broader opportunities for women who were having trouble finding a suitable donor. However, then we did a subsequent analysis where we looked just at the status one patients, and I was fortunate to do this with Dr. Rebecca Cogswell at the University of Minnesota. And we saw that similarly to prior, if you just looked at the status one patients, women had a significantly lower rate of being transplanted. And I believe the hazard ratio was 1.48, so a 48% increased risk of delisting or death compared to men. We tried to answer the question that you posed, which is how much of that is due to complications of mechanical circulatory support. And interestingly, there were a percentage of men and women who were not on ECMO and were listed as status one. And even after controlling for ECMO or VAD or the absence of either, we found that overall our findings were still unchanged, highlighting that there was still something about status one that we don't fully understand. Of course, this doesn't mean that women are not getting complications from MCS, because we do know that with smaller caliber vessels, ECMO cannulation may be more difficult. Oftentimes, we like to do upper extremity cannulation to improve ambulation, and that may not be feasible in women with smaller body size. So I think more studies are needed in that respect. But these are definitely important considerations. Like you said, even once people make it to decision, kind of what their trajectory will be like and how we can counsel women.
Well, if I may, I'd like to move us away from advanced heart failure just for a moment and focus on some of the cardiomyopathies. As we know, there's certain cardiomyopathies that affect women more commonly than men, and there's some that affect the genders in equal proportion. But specifically, I guess, Celia, if you don't mind, could you bring us up to date with anything that's new in regards to peripartum cardiomyopathy that you think our listeners should be aware of in regards to the diagnosis and management or prognostication of that disease process? And in regards to other cardiomyopathies, such as hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or infiltrative cardiomyopathies, stress-induced cardiomyopathy, which tends to seem to present more commonly in women, is there anything else that we should be mindful about with gender differences in regards to either making the diagnosis of these things or providing treatment for these patients?
Well, thanks so much, Michael. So with respect to peripartum cardiomyopathy, I think, or at least I'd like to think, that there's been an increasing recognition and focus on the area of cardio-obstetrics and rising maternal mortality in the United States. And of course, we still have a lot of work to do in terms of improving outcomes and particularly racial disparities. One thing that I would like to raise awareness of for people on the who are listening, which is that there has been prior data about the role of bromocriptine in peripartum cardiomyopathy. And there's an ongoing clinical trial that's enrolling called Rebirth, which is seeking to study the role of bromocriptine in peripartum cardiomyopathy in the United States. So it's just something to think about if you encounter a patient with peripartum cardiomyopathy and you are a center that's participating. I think that will be really exciting and to be able to review the outcomes of that trial. As for the other cardiomyopathies, one thing that I've always found interesting, and I can't say I have the answers for, but when we talk about ATTR amyloidosis, which is a cardiomyopathy that has a lot of new and exciting and effective treatment modalities, really, by and large, like 80 to 90% of the participants in these trials are men. And it's really hard to find women with TTR amyloid. And I guess the question is why. So when we have looked at women with amyloid, they tend to have a higher ejection fraction and a lower wall thickness, which makes me wonder, either is there something about ATTR amyloid where it's truly a men's disease, or is it that we need sex-specific diagnostic criteria? And by perhaps changing the wall thickness cutoffs or our gestalt that we use, and we're just not testing women? That's not a question I have the answer to. I just think it's interesting. And I think it's also been implied, I think, in some of these studies when we're looking at heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, right? How many of those individuals actually have undiagnosed amyloidosis? And so I think trying to understand the prevalence in men versus women is still an unanswered question and could also impact how we interpret the results of those trials. So again, I don't have the answers, but something that I thought about and find very fascinating.
I think really a call to arms, right, Celia, that one of the manifestos for all of us should be enrollment and representation, right? Because we're such a data-driven community as we should be, but what are we extrapolating our data from? What does our pool look like? And to your point, to come up with new criteria that's a little bit more personalized, you do need to have representation. So you need to have more women actually enrolled in trials for these quote-unquote niche cardiomyopathies, because we may find that our true prevalence is very different in our communities. But if our communities don't represent the world we live in, it's a difficult thing to actually assess. So really a kind of a call to arms for all of us who are doing basic and clinical research to understand our patient cohort and how it really should be representative of the world that we live in. So I think that is definitely one of these things that's something that we can change and be more mindful of as we include sex as a definer of what our patient characteristics should be when we accrue and enroll patients. But thank you very much. Any parting thoughts, Celia? I'm just going to keep everybody on the call, but I am going to call up our other two silent, but not going to be silent for long, guests, Catherine and Eileen. And these ladies really are the representatives for an incredible collective called the Women in Transplant and MCS. Celia and I have been members of this group since it started a few years ago, and I'm going to give it over to Dr. Sheesh and Dr. Clark. Dr. Sheesh, if you wouldn't mind just giving us a little introduction about Women in Transplant and MCS, about what the group is about, how it started, and tell us more for those of us who haven't heard about it.
Forward to it. I have to take an opportunity, though. I am going to actually inspire Dr. Jeff Philippus. You've got another research project in front of you. That last question you can easily answer. It's not hard. It's easy. All we have to do is actually do family trees, do genetic studies, kind of like the UK has been doing an excellent job on that, because I know that can be done. And actually, I remember that when my patient came to me thinking he had hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, buried his brother, came in to say, I don't want to be next. We found out, and he said it was only the men that died. We found out he had TTR. You could take those families, and his sister had it too. And all the other sisters had it. But we didn't ask that question. That can be answered. There you go. Okay. Another project.
Done. Part of the mission statement for Women in Transplant and MCS. Dr. Sheesh is living it right now.
Yeah. So this is exciting times. I mean, I think it's exciting from so many different angles. There's exciting because things continue to grow and we make a lot of progress with research. And we also are making progress in our own field as women actually enter the field itself. And yet at some level, we're still not quite there. So the current stats are that less than 15% of adult cardiologists are female, that less than 20% of academic cardiologists are female. And then when you look at the chief of cardiology, only 20% are female across the United States. And this is despite the fact that in 2017, we actually had more women than men entering medical school. That's just wild. I mean, in 1960, there was less than 10% female students. And then in 1980, it was about 25%. And then in 2017, there's more than 50%, but we still don't have actually a presence. And we still don't have the kind of mentoring necessary that is not going to be at one institution because there aren't enough. So for many years, we've been discussing how are we going to do this? And we get together at different meetings. And how are we going to train the next generations? And Dr. Shelley Hall succeeded. She had, I think it was two meetings. The very first was a social. And everyone got on and kind of just talked. It was a Zoom meeting during the pandemic. So perfect time for actually virtual get-togethers. Somebody emailed, I don't know who it was, and said, I'm only willing to put in the time if this becomes something real. And at that point, we had one more meeting, and about 13 of us, that's it, showed up to that Zoom call. We decided to create a virtual university. That's what it was. With that, we actually decided, what do you need to learn when you go to school? How do you become an academic clinician. What do you need as your skill sets? And so we created actually these little different sections and paired a senior with a junior, and then also created three board members, Shelley being the president, Dr. Hannah Copeland as the vice chair president, and the secretary was Dr. Phyllis Bilia. And that's how we got started. And we started with 13 people getting together, making a plan. And we grew to over 300 participants during the pandemic. And it got so hard to control all the stuff that was being generated because there was so much participation. The enthusiasm was unbelievable that we decided we needed to create our own internet webpage to be able to share and to actually go to something. And that actually is how we ended up having an organization, because it became more complicated. We needed money to actually set up the website. We needed actually then, once you have money, and we easily raised it, and Dr. Catherine Clark is going to talk about that. But once we raised it, somebody has to put in a bank account, and then somebody has to pay the taxes, and it gets far more difficult. And you have to have an accountant, and it just became all of a sudden an organization. And how cool is that? And so I'm going to just do briefly what I do, and Dr. Catherine Clark is going to talk about the other aspect, but I've been with the group as one of the founders, and I co-chair my session with Dr. Dorini Ramu, and it's the educational session. And you would think that I'm educating you on heart failure transplant, but you already know that. So you do not need my education there, but what we'll train you to do is actually learn how to actually be a moderator or speaker by getting your own opportunities, by submitting excellent proposals. And we teach you how to write an excellent proposal. And we pair people off, and then we work as a group. And we work with groups by emails, we work with groups by Zoom meetings, but we share. And you become friends with people. I actually felt like I knew them. I had been working with people for so long by Zoom that I felt like I knew them. And you know individuals, and the mentoring kind of happened and grew naturally. And so we were submitting for the ATC, the ACC, the HFSA, and ISHLT, and we were quite successful because we have some very talented people in our group. And what was also surprising to me is how talented people were that had never done this before, that had never had an opportunity to actually be a speaker or moderator, despite being actually the director of their transplant program. And yet, because of their brilliance and their creativity, they were able to create some of the best proposals I've ever seen and were able to actually be speakers and moderators. And what was really exciting, because we've been doing this for at least 3 years now, was at our last one that we submitted, which was ATC, we kind of joined up with the guys and we worked together in a bigger committee. And it was so much fun. And the emails were flying. So we've been quite successful because of the enthusiasm, because of the creativity. But it's really a skill set. I think that's something that people don't realize until you actually see the difference between a successful proposal and then one that you didn't know the rules. Okay. Dr. Clark, I'm going to let you take over and kind of tell us how we grew and what happened.
Thank you, Dr. Sheese. This has been a fabulous opportunity for me. I joined the Women in Transplant and MCS group about now almost 2 years ago. Saw, I think, probably one of Celia's posts on social media and Twitter and said, I want to get involved. With my business background, I offered to join Shelley, Hannah, and Phyllis as a treasurer and contribute in a way that perhaps other people couldn't, and to provide my skills to this group. Through that, have learned some interesting skill sets, how to incorporate as a nonprofit organization, work on the taxes and all that fun accounting, as well as learn how to get sponsors to create a sustainable organization to help women strive and grow. And one of our mottos is lift as we climb, help each other. As myself, I am early in my academic career and learning these next stepping stones. It's been fabulous to work with amazingly talented women from not only all over the country, but internationally. I've learned so much already. Eileen's point, I had never worked and submitted a symposia proposal prior to this. And it's been fun. Everybody just dives in and helps each other and finds creative titles and ideas. And it was a fabulous learning experience and working to get to know each other through a common cause. For this past year, I got to moderate one of the sessions at ACC. It was the first time. I then reached out to Eileen and said, how do I do this? Give me some tips. So it was a fabulous experience for myself. And I hope to do the same for others as well coming up in fellows. When I interview them for Heart Failure Fellowship, make sure I pitch it. I think importantly now, we've grown dramatically. We have our website. Please visit it, www.witmcs.com. Become a member. Anyone, I think, can become a member. And this isn't only for physicians and fellows, not only your trainees and your medical students, but we also want our program coordinators, our APPs. I was just speaking today with my APP and showing her the website, saying what wonderful things we want to do. We not only want to grow nationally, but internationally, as we have meetings at ISHLT. And I think moving forward along those lines, we want to also create patient resources and videos, how to drive line stressing changes, and just flourish the organization to that degree. So I welcome everybody at any stage of their career and all the entirety of heart transplant MCS programs to promote this goal. It's been fun and amazing to get to work with everybody. I think also something to note, Eileen mentioned that we have lots of different subcommittees. So we, whatever your interests are, however you want to contribute, we have committees that kind of span the gamut from working on symposia, mentorship, doing research projects together, multi-site collaborations, as well as advocacy efforts, both from the patient and physician perspective. So we only want to grow more and we're open for any suggestions how we can even derive more benefit for our members and growing membership.
That's awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much. It really is a pretty awesome and supportive family. So all are welcome. And thanks so much for joining us, Dr. DeFilippis, Dr. Sheesh, Dr. Clark, Dr. Beasley, for being an amazing co-host. Thank you all for your time. And I hope everyone enjoys this podcast and there's much more to look forward to. Again, thanks again, folks. It was a great, great chat.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to From Failure to Function. Happy 2024 to all our listeners from our Heart Failure Beat crew. Hoping everyone in the audience had a great and restful end to their 2023 and looking forward to exciting new discoveries and new adventures in 2024. But some trials that remained on my mind through the holidays included the ARES HCM3 trial, the results of which were discussed at the American Heart Association's meeting in November. The objective of the trial was to determine whether excluding aspirin as part of the antithrombotic regimen with a fully magnetically levitated LVAD was safe and indeed decreased bleeding. This was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study of aspirin 100 milligrams per day versus placebo with vitamin K antagonist therapy in patients with an LVAD. The study was conducted at 51 centers across 9 countries. In total, 628 patients, 314 in the placebo group and 314 in the aspirin group, were enrolled, of which 296 patients in the placebo group and 293 in the aspirin group were included in the primary analysis. The median follow-up was 14 months. The composite primary endpoint was assessed for non-inferiority and was looking at survival free from a major non-surgical hemocompatibility-related adverse event that included stroke, pump thrombosis, major bleeding, or arterial peripheral thromboembolism at 12 months. The principal secondary endpoint was non-surgical bleeding events. Of the 589 analyzed patients, 77% were men, 1/3 were black, and 61% were white. More patients were alive and free of hemocompatibility events at 12 months in the placebo group versus those taking aspirin. Non-inferiority of placebo was demonstrated with an absolute between-group difference of 6% improvement in event-free survival with placebo, with a p-value less than 0.01. aspirin avoidance was associated with reduced non-surgical bleeding events, but no increase in stroke or other thromboembolic events, a finding consistent amongst diverse subgroups of patient characteristics. The relevance to our field is that in patients with advanced heart failure treated with a fully magnetically levitated LVAD, avoidance of antithrombotic regimen, which includes a vitamin K antagonist, is not inferior to a regimen containing aspirin. It does not increase the thromboembolism risk and is associated with a reduction in bleeding events. The full results of the trial can be accessed on JAMA. Shifting gears a little bit to a hot-off-the-press trial in circulation heart failure this month, the ENACT-HF study, a trial that interrogates our use of different paradigms for decongestion in the hospital. This study investigated the feasibility and efficacy of a standardized natriuresis-guided diuretic protocol in patients with acute heart failure and signs of volume overload. It was an international multi-center open-label two-phase study comparing the current standard of care of each center with a standardized diuretic protocol, including urinary sodium to guide therapy. The primary endpoint was natriuresis after 1 day. Secondary endpoints included cumulative natriuresis and diuresis after 2 days of treatment, length of stay, and in-hospital mortality. 401 patients from 29 centers in 18 countries were included in the study. The natriuresis after 1 day was significantly higher in the protocol arm compared with the standard of care arm, 282 versus 174 millimoles, with a p-value of less than 0.01. After 2 days, the natriuresis remained higher in the protocol arm, 538 versus 365 millimoles, with a significantly higher associated diuresis, 5.7 liters versus 4.3 liters with an adjusted mean ratio of 1.33, where the protocol arm had a shorter length of stay, 5.8 days versus 7 days, with a p-value of 0.036. In-hospital mortality was low and did not significantly differ between the two arms. Takeaways from the trial seem to suggest that standardized natriuresis-guided diuretic protocols to guide decongestion in acute heart failure are feasible, they are safe, and resulted in higher natriuresis and diuresis, as well as a shorter length of stay.
On behalf of Michael and myself, we want to thank you for tuning into the Heart Failure Beat.
We'll catch you next time with more exciting news and discussions from the world of heart failure.
The opinions expressed by the hosts and guests of this podcast are their own and not necessarily those of the Heart Failure Society of America. For more information and to subscribe to the podcast, visit hfsa.org/hfbeat. Follow HFSA on Twitter and look for us at #HFBeat.